Good afternoon, everyone. First of all, I'd like to call the HHS Finance Committee to order. I would like to announce to the many, many people in the room here, we're very pleased with your interest. We're glad you're here, but we have a room that is over capacity. So we are setting up another room where you can go and be more comfortable, room 181 in this building. It's on the first floor. We will have a television there so that you can watch the proceedings in a little more comfort. I apologize for this. It would be great if we had bigger hearing rooms here in the state office building, but if some of you could make your way down to 181, that would be great. Otherwise, you know, we don't want to upset the fire marshal or anything like that. So we'll give you a few minutes to do that, and we won't actually begin our proceedings for a few minutes to give folks time to get down there. Thank you. All right. Well, good afternoon again, everyone. Thank you for your cooperation, and to those who moved to room 181, thank you very much for doing that. If there are seats, if you are sitting next to an empty seat, would you raise your hand, please? Not seeing any. Okay, so we are full. So those who are standing in the back, just know that we are also showing the, we have the TV going in 181, so there, I don't know if there are seats down there, but there is, that is also available. So thank you, everybody. We are going to hear the first bill. We are still one member short of a quorum, so we can't officially move the bill, but we will do that as soon as we get another member in the room. So we're going to start with Representative Cantrell's bill, House File 1043, and I will ask you to just present your bill briefly, Representative Cantrell, and then we have quite a few testifiers on the list. We have six already now. And then, of course, we'll have an opportunity for people in the audience to testify if they wish. I just want to caution all the testifiers. We have a full agenda. We want to give everyone an opportunity. So we are going to limit testimony to just a couple of minutes. And if you're in the room and the spirit moves you to testify, of course, we would allow you to do that. But we really need it to be brief and once we get the full picture, we will want to go ahead and move on with our agenda. So thank you very much. And actually, we do have a quorum now. So Representative Cantrell is, you're not on this committee, are you?
I am.
Yes, you are.
Yes, Madam Chair. I need to ask more questions.
Yes. Thank you. You know, members, because we have more than one Health and Human Service Committee, and I constantly forget which members are on one and not the other. So sorry about that, Representative Cantrell. So Representative Cantrell will move that House File 1043 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS finance bill. So with that, Representative Cantrell, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. It's an honor to present before you today House File 1043. And first, I want to start off by thanking the majority of the members on this committee for supporting this bill, for supporting the cause of alleviating housing instability in the state of Minnesota. This is a bipartisan issue, and it is an honor to be able to carry this piece of legislation with such incredible support. Homelessness is at times an invisible issue. While we may see individuals standing at a corner with a sign and brand them as homeless, we often don't see the countless individuals and their families who are sleeping in cars, spending the night in ice houses in sub-zero weather. And we oftentimes don't see a lot of the extenuating circumstances that lead to someone struggling with housing instability. In Burnsville, In 2016, there was a family that had to spend a couple nights in their car under an overpass during the coldest bout of winter weather that we had experienced all year. And they had a five-year-old child that they didn't have anywhere to go. The family and didn't have anywhere to stay. And to me, that is an unacceptable state of affairs in the state of Minnesota. When kids and families have to sleep in cars because there's not enough resources to help them, when churches have to operate as auxiliary homeless shelters because there's nowhere else for folks to go, We need to do better. And that's what this bill seeks to do. It seeks to ensure that we as a legislature and we as a state don't leave folks behind, especially not the most vulnerable among us. So with that, Madam Chair and members, I'm going to turn this presentation over to the Executive Director for the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless, who will enumerate more of the provisions in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cantrell. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Senta Leff, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. I'm also co-chair of the Homes for All campaign. That represents over 250 statewide nonprofit and for-profit partners. As you may have noticed, today is Homeless Day on the Hill. Raise your hand if you're here for Homeless Day on the Hill.
Well, that's wonderful. Have everyone.
So more than 800 advocates have come from every corner of the state to support this bill and the full legislative agenda, which takes us from prevention and emergency response all the way to affordable home ownership. I'll briefly walk through House File 1043, and all of these requests are base and biennial increases. So Section 1 is a $100 per month increase to housing supports, formerly known as GRH, which is an increasingly critical but constrained resource. The base rate of $904 a month falls short of increasing rents and the rising cost of living. The program serves 20,000 disabled adults and/or elderly Minnesotans statewide, with St. Louis, Olmsted, Clay, Beltrami, and Hennepin counties serving the highest number of Minnesotans. Moving on to Section 2, a request for an additional $11.2 million for the Homeless Youth Act, which funds programs that serve homeless youth, youth at risk of homelessness, and runaway youth. On any given night in Minnesota, roughly 6,000 youth experience homelessness. Section 3 of the bill is a $15 million increase to the Emergency Services Program, or ESP. ESP is Minnesota's primary source for emergency shelter and services, and it is currently funded at $844,000 a year. Minnesota's unsheltered population is spiking dangerously. Since 2014, the number of unsheltered Minnesotans has grown by more than 40%. Section 4 of the bill is a $2 million request for housing supports for adults with serious mental illness, which allows providers to improve the mental health services offered to adults with serious and persistent mental illness and promotes really creative partnerships between state facilities and community mental health services. More than 10,000 Minnesotans exited residential treatment for mental or chemical health in fiscal year 18, and of those, one out of every eight exited directly into homelessness. Section 5 is a $1.8 million increase for the Long-Term Homeless Support Services Fund. It serves Minnesotans who have been homeless for a full year, or at least four times in the past 3 years. Funding is used flexibly to stabilize these individuals and families and young adults who are living in supportive housing. It also leverages partnerships among counties, schools, and other community providers for cost-effective services that address the needs of Minnesotans with some of the highest barriers to housing stability. Finally, I'll just leave you with the cost of homelessness is really, really high. The federal government estimates that repeated episodes of homelessness cost taxpayers as much as $30,000 to $50,000 per year. So the investments that we're proposing today are less expensive than the alternative and actually save taxpayers money. Thank you for the opportunity.
All right. Folks, let me just announce, you know, we, notwithstanding that we applauded all of you being here, in committee, we have this sort of formality, and we can't have audience reaction after people testify, so please, no applause, even though we know that we all love and appreciate a lot of the testifiers we'll be hearing. We just can't applaud in committee, so thank you for your cooperation with that. welcome to the committee. And also, folks, if we're going to do that as well, we're using up precious time that we need to give our testifiers. So welcome to the committee, ma'am. Please give us your name and go ahead and give us your testimony.
My name is Janelle Freeman Anderson. My testimony is for the $15 million for emergency shelter program. I thank you, Chair, the chairs, for having me here and the community to speak. My name is Janelle Anderson, Freeman Anderson. I am speaking here today as a member of Street Voice of Change, which is a group of over 120 people that experience homelessness who are working to make positive changes in the experiences of homelessness. I am here to talk about the need of the $15 million for emergency services. I've been homeless for 10 years, off and on. And I grew up in Minnesota. I'm born and raised in Minnesota. And I've been couch hopping. I've been homeless over in other states too. I have couch hop, and I've been in family shelters, and I have left my kids with other family because single people were being treated better. But that was hard to do, to let my kids stay with people. Lucky to find housing because I knew somebody that found housing for somebody else, so I started talking to them to find housing. And that's how I found my housing. It tripled in Minnesota. It doubled in Minnesota. Every day I see people that's in the streets, on the corners, everywhere. Since 2015. And this problem impacted people of color like me, who make up 63% of the unsheltered population. The cost of living have always gone up. Income have been going up. Have not grown. I mean, the money haven't been going up, but housing is harder. It's getting harder and harder and harder to find housing. It's getting harder and harder to find anything. I'm trying to make it short and sweet. That's why I'm trying to take out some things.
That's fine. And you know what, ma'am? I know it's hard to testify in front of all these people and in front of the committee, but if you just tell us in your own words, you know, that sometimes that's even more effective. So don't be nervous. Go ahead and just, you know, let us hear from you, because your testimony is valuable to us.
Well, I feel like we need more than this $15 million to help the homeless people.
I feel like we need more than this.
Because we need help. I mean, if you take a look outside, we need help. And it's not gonna go away overnight, but we need help. We need help with staffs. We need help with the shelters. We need help with keeping them clean. We need help doing everything. And the money that they do get right now is not enough. It's not enough money. And the shelter need training people to help us too, because there's a lot of people with mental illness in there that they're not trained and they're not equipped to handle those people, and the people end up outside in the streets at nighttime, and what happened to them.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Please, no applause, but we really do appreciate your testimony. Thank you for that. Next testifier, welcome to the committee. Hi, just give us your name and give us your testimony.
All right. Well, thank you for inviting me and of this committee. My name is LaRonda Lake, and I have experienced homelessness, and I am here in the support of the Homeless Youth Act, A little bit about me. What led to me being homeless is being in foster care. And soon as I hit 18, I was kicked out. So coming to Minneapolis and living in a real world, very different for me. So for years off and on, I was just couch hopping as well. And, you know, living around my family, which, you know, wasn't the best situation to be in. Years later down the road, I've heard of The Link. My therapist kept trying. I was in one of the shelters then, Salvation Army, and that wasn't the healthiest place either. So The Link, my therapist, got in contact with The Link, and it helped me become stronger. It helped me do so much more and want to, you know, have this passion and be able to speak to you guys and to keep funding and to get this out there. Their support is phenomenal. I am today living in my own apartment, working dietary aid and PCA, personal care assistance, and I don't want to be a product of my environment. So now I'm just working extra hard and, you know, to keep living, I guess, every day and to become better than what I am today. And without the Link program, I probably would have still been homeless and not doing as much. But it encouraged me to go back and get my GED and, you know, like I said, not be what they say about my past and just be me and live for today. So, you guys should definitely, give more. These places really help people. It gives the youth a chance to be able to have so much more opportunity than just, you know, sleeping on somebody's couch. It gives them the courage and be like, oh, I got this, so I can definitely go and get that. What steps can I make to further my career? What steps can I further myself instead of being stuck? So, yes, I appreciate you guys' time for listening to me. And definitely, The Link is where it's at.
Thank you, so much. Thank you for your testimony, very inspirational testimony. Could we have the next testifier, please? Welcome to the committee. Please give us your name and go ahead.
Hello, I am Gina Coutts. I am the Homeless Programs Manager for Clay County Housing and Redevelopment Authority. We have been using the Housing Supports Program since 2010 in Clay County for people who are experiencing homelessness. It is a proven program that we've been using for room and board for adults who are low income and have a disability and or are 65 years or older. It serves people in both congregate and scattered site settings. So congregate is the shelter settings or treatment settings, and then scattered site would be in their own independent apartments. The room and board rate for housing supports is $904 a month for scattered and congregate sites. For the site-based settings, though, at least $192 of those dollars need to be used for food. In West Central Minnesota, where Clay County is, there are 674 households on our homeless priority list right now. Housing supports is often the only option available for them. And also in the last 2 weeks, 144 households, including 16 families, have sought shelter in Clay counties, and our shelters are doing overflow because of the weather right now. They are way past capacity. As of 2015, the median rent in Clay County has increased by over 25%, and Clay County has the unfortunate ability to be the one that has the highest amount of people who are rent burdened in Minnesota, with 53% of Clay County residents paying either 30 to 50% over their income for just housing expenses. So as an example, recently we had a gentleman who went into one of our shelters after leaving a treatment facility. He had employment, but it wasn't stable enough for him to be able to actually afford an apartment. And then he also was still struggling with his sobriety and mental health issues. Because of housing supports, he was able to find housing and is now gainfully employed in a longer-term situation where he is able to afford his housing. We also use our housing supports program at our Gateway Gardens apartments in Moorhead, which opened in 2010. And since then, we've had a 91% rate of housing stability for that building. We've also opened another building called Bright Sky Apartments last year, which is utilizing, but it's because it just opened last year, we don't have the statistics yet on that. In our scattered site settings, we have over 100 households just in Clay County that are in apartment settings on their own. And we, since 2017, when we started that program, 92% of them remain housed at this time. And those who have left, almost 80% of them have left for permanent housing. We have great success working with the scattered site participants, especially those who owe significant child support, as the program allows a person to work and actually afford housing at the same time as still supporting their family. Many fathers are very proud of this fact. In fact, I had somebody call me yesterday and say, I am no longer a deadbeat dad, I am just dad. So the housing supports program is a vital tool in our Clay County area to be able to address the housing issues. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. So as folks see, there are going to be some seats available here if people want to fill in. I also want to announce the last testifier talked about something being way past capacity. Well, we are way past capacity and as well, and that just shows how important this issue is to everybody, which I'm very gratified to know. But I do want to announce that the basement hearing room is also open for people who want to watch this hearing. Room 181 is beyond capacity. So if you have a seat in the room here immediately, you know, please grab the seats that are available. There shouldn't be anybody standing if we have seats available here. And once again, folks, if you have an empty seat next to you, could you raise your hand so that people know that there's a seat? Yeah, please do. Raise your hand if there's an empty seat next to you so someone can come and sit. Thank you for that. Please, the folks in the back, if you can fill in, take a seat if you can. All right. Thank you very much. And for those watching on TV, the basement hearing room is open as well. Welcome to the committee. Please give us your name and go ahead and give us your testimony.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you. My name is Pete Charpentier, and I am the Homes for All Regional Lead for the Central Minnesota Continuum of Care and the Minnesota Tribal Collaborative to Prevent and End Homelessness. The Central COC represents 13 Minnesota counties, Cass, Crow Wing, Todd, Morrison, Mille Lacs, Kennebec, Pine, Isanti, Chisago, Stearns, Benton, Sherburn, and Wright. The Tribal Collaborative represents six northern Ojibwe tribes, Mille Lacs, White Earth, Boys Fort, Fond du Lac, Leech Lake, and Red Lake. I currently work in the Mille Lacs area and serve homeless populations with severe and persistent mental illnesses, traumatic brain injuries, substance use, criminal justice involvement, and significant trauma. Frequently, a combination of these barriers exists. Homelessness looks different in greater Minnesota than it does in the metro area. It's hidden. People are couch hopping, staying with friends or relatives, exhausting their natural supports. We don't have access to shelter. The closest shelter to my office is 60 miles away and typically full, which means I often have to transport people to the metro area for shelter. Stable and safe housing is foundational for all aspects of life. Mental health recovery is impossible when you are constantly in crisis due to a lack of housing. Housing supports for adults with serious mental illness and long-term homeless supportive services are vital programs that help the chronically homeless. Almost 2,000 people access these programs statewide as the first step toward recovery. Without these programs, many people have been relegated to the revolving door of emergency room visits, criminal justice involvement. Without stable and supportive housing, we lack the ability to address recovery. Racial disparity plays another role in homelessness. According to the 2019 point-in-time count in the Central Continuum of Care, Native Americans or Alaskan Natives represent 25% of the homeless population, yet are only 1.3% of the overall population. These numbers are shocking, yet they convey the reality that many members of the Native American community face on a regular basis. Our communities need stronger systems and increased capacity to serve our members on a local level, especially those with mental illnesses. People in greater Minnesota need programs that are culturally relevant and adaptable to their community needs so that individuals and families stay closer to their natural supports. Thank you for hearing my testimony, and please support HF 1043.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next testifier, please. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Dave Matuslam, Chief Deputy of the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office. Before I share what the Sheriff's Office experienced during this extreme cold winter, I want to acknowledge services we provided are just one spoke in the wheel of services provided to unsheltered persons by Ramsey County through its various departments, the nonprofit community, including the unbelievable shelter work performed by Catholic Charities, and other government entities such as the Metro Transit Police through their Home Action Team. 4 days prior to the latest polar vortex, Ramsey County Sheriff Bob Fletcher asked senior staff to work with other county leadership, the nonprofit community, and other law enforcement agencies to see if we could come up with a plan to mitigate some of the dangers for the homeless population during that cold weather. The result was a collaboration with Catholic Charities, Metro Transit Police, and Ramsey County to provide 4 nights of shelter for anywhere from 79 to 129 people staying at the local train station, Union Depot. We provided bedding and transportation. Spire Credit Union donated breakfast meals, Walgreens donated hand warmers, and dozens of individuals gave clothing or other monetary donations that were needed. Unfortunately, this wasn't the end of the dangerously cold weather. For an additional 8 nights in February, it was determined that additional emergency shelter space would be needed. The Ramsey County Manager and Board Chair worked with the City of St. Paul to provide variances to temporarily increase the capacity for winter safe space and higher ground by 46 beds. The Sheriff's Office, along with Metro Transit and Catholic Charities, once again collaborated to assist individuals in receiving placement and transportation to shelter. Once the shelters were full, the Law Enforcement Center lobby was open for overflow. On average, 40 to 50 individuals were sheltered at the Law Enforcement Center on each of 8 nights. This experience changed all of us. Our deputies and correctional officers developed a deeper appreciation for those who are homeless and without shelter. We found out that they also appreciated us. Some deputies commented that they heard the words thank you and God bless you more in a few nights than they do in a typical year. In short, we humanized each other. There are dozens of stories that I could share. Here are just a couple. One of our deputies who volunteered for multiple shifts during the vortex discovered her homeless brother sleeping in our lobby. It had been 10 years since their family had had contact. On Monday, because of the media exposure, our office was in a position to accept a call from an employer who had an unsheltered and homeless employee. We were able to connect them with Catholic Charities, who were able to find him with some housing. There are many lessons that we learned during this time. There continues to be a significant need for affordable housing and shelter space. Our light rail system often serves as a de facto shelter. And finally, that homelessness is really a statewide issue and it really needs a statewide solution. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We will, I don't know if at this point, Representative Cantrell, if you had any comment, we will open it up. Please go ahead if you do, but we will give people in the audience a chance to testify on the bill if they so choose. If there's anyone in the audience that wishes to add additional testimony, I would give you 1 minute to testify. Is there anyone, please raise your hand if you would like to testify. Okay, please come up to the table, ma'am. And anyone else? All right, so we'll let this lady testify and then we'll give Representative Cantrell a chance to make a comment and then we will ask members if they have questions. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Megan Kniff. My family's lived in Minnesota for at least 3 generations. My father and my grandfather were here. But I have an idea. If we could find a way to get the realtors to take less money for less of a profit for the houses they sell, and then not have people make fun of them because they do, it would like make it in style. Or make it bring back the quality, the valor, and the honor, the sense of honor of helping people when they're in trouble and not just taking as much as you can for a house. And then, of course, there's this business of talking to the house buyer to refuse to pay a certain amount. But find a way to get set that in motion and not make fun of the realtor. I think they'd be more willing to take a lower profit. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. And, ma'am, if you could, the page will give you something to sign so we capture your name and know who you are. Is there a page? Oh, there it is. Okay, good. Very good. Representative Cantrell or Ms. Leff, if you want to make a closing comment, and then we'll see if members have any questions or comments. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In closing, I want to thank all the testifiers for their very moving testimony. This is a matter of, I think, basic human dignity in the state of Minnesota, and especially when our weather gets as cold as it does, thinking about folks that that don't have anywhere to go, whether they're in Burnsville or whether they're in St. Paul or whether they're in Ely. I mean, it's something that we absolutely need to take action on, because we can't leave any of our fellow Minnesotans behind. So I just want to thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank the members of the committee and all the testifiers.
All right. Thank you, Representative Cantrell. We have a question. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cantrell, can you tell us what the base appropriations are for these programs, for the Homeless Youth Act and for the Emergency Services Grants? It's the four different funding groups in the bill.
Representative Cantrell? Or guess Mr. Berg will address that. Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, the four programs named in the bill, Section 2, the Homeless Youth Act, the current base appropriation in 20 and 21 is $5,512,000 annually. For Section 3, the Emergency Services Grant, you heard testimony, the base appropriation in the upcoming biennium is $844,000 annually. For Section 4, the Housing Supports, the base appropriation is $4,550,000 annually. And for the Section 5, the Long-Term Homeless Support Services, the base is $6,910,000 annually.
And Mr. Berg, these numbers are all in the budget book that members were given. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. There, you can find those in the grant table at the back of the DHS section.
Okay. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I see some of them are almost doubled, but the emergency services grants that has a current base appropriation of $844,000, your ask is to add an additional $7.5 million to that. What would the emergency service grants be used for? And I guess one of my concerns is sometimes people ask for a lot of money for programs, but they can't be spent in that fiscal year as the program's ramping up. So the money, the $7.5 million per year, there's detailed plans on how that'll be spent?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the Emergency Services Program is a very flexible pot of funding. It's not a bricks and mortar program, so this would not be building new emergency shelters. An example of a way that it could be used immediately, in 63 of our 87 counties, we have no fixed site to shelter, so vast majority. And as I think has been made clear, just because you live a couple hundred miles from an emergency shelter certainly doesn't mean that you don't need one. So those dollars could be used as motel vouchers in rural communities, where instead of sleeping in a heated doghouse or out on inside of an ice house on a frozen lake, you could have a motel for a few nights until you're connected to something better. Okay. Just as an example.
Okay. Right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Munson. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. Obviously, homelessness is one of probably the most disappointing results of our society. We've printed up trillions of dollars, and yet it seems homelessness has gotten much worse than, 30, 40 years ago, which tells you that printing up trillions of dollars is probably not the answer to a lot of things. It makes things worse in the long run. But anyway, that's just a statement. But my question is, I was just looking at the bill, and maybe I missed it, but is there a cap on administrative cost in the bill? Because we'd like to get as much money of this to actually to the people who need it versus administration.
Sure, Representative Grunhagen. Is that, Mr. Berg, is that something you could address?
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, the numbers I mentioned before for the base was for the grants portion. Those are actual grants to services. As you probably know, we administration at DHS is rolled up into a separate set of lines, so the numbers I gave you are all for services to individuals, not admin.
Okay.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you for that response. So what is the approximate percentage of administration, do you know, or is that above your pay grade today?
Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I don't know on a per grant program basis. I don't know the answer to that. DHS is a very large agency yep. with quite a bit of administration, but we break it out by programmatically, like health care or children's and families or continuing care for older adults, and to get it down to this programmatic level, well, I'd have to consult with the department.
Okay.
All right, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, you know, inside the bill we have Section 2, we have different appropriations. Are these being administered by one department, or is it separate departments administering this? And would there be any efficiency if it is different departments? Wouldn't it make more sense, I mean, that's just my perspective, to have one department administer these? Or how does it work? Is it numerous departments, or is it one department that actually administers?
Well, Representative Grunhagen, I think they're all the Department of Human Services, if I'm not mistaken, right? I'm seeing heads nodding over there. This is all under the Department of Human Services.
Okay. It seems broken up in the bill, but anyway.
Okay. All right. Well, seeing no other questions, so I just want to explain. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if there's somebody from DHS here. Thank you, Representative Cantrell, for bringing this forward, and I appreciate the testimony. I am a co-author on two other housing bills, housing trust funds, which are another important component of this, and housing tax credits. And my question is, again, how do these pieces all work together? And there's the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. I don't know if, as you've worked on this bill, you know, if you have some expertise in how these components and different funding streams come together, or if somebody from DHS could address that.
All right. We've got someone from DHS coming down. I saw they were trying to figure out who it was going to be, but you drew the short straw, so welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Christine Davis with the Department of Human Services. And I'll say the Department of Human Services works very closely with Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. And every year, Minnesota Housing Finance Agency has funding mechanism for new housing developments. And many of those projects, most of those projects, incorporate some of the funding for services needed for people in those residences for supportive housing. So we do have quite a bit of overlap and work closely together.
So just for my...
of Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just for my clarification... would it be, is it correct then to say, so Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and DHS may have programs that work with developers for housing units, and would Homes for All and these funds go to the nonprofits that help the customer here in the room qualify for the housing or get a voucher for the housing or use the housing?
Right.
Is that a way to net it out?
Ms. Davis, right?
Yes.
Madam Chair, Representative, you're correct. The funding for from Minnesota Housing Finance Agency office often is funding the capital, the bricks and mortar, and sometimes operating. And the Department of Human Services provides funding. Some of it may be income supports for people living in those settings, or it might be the supportive services that help them according to their need. So they would be complementary, not covering the same thing.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you for your response. So I just wanted to let the audience know we're going to this bill is going to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Finance Bill. And what that means is when we put our omnibus bill together and decide how our entire budget will be assembled, this bill will be in consideration, and We will certainly do the best we can to fund these very important items. And thank you to everyone who's been here to testify and people who came today to make sure that this important issue is brought to the front. So thank you. The bill is laid over.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
What are we missing? We need, why do we continue to see this?
We have to keep it from
okay. And to the audience, please, if you could leave quietly because the committee needs to continue with its business. Folks, please take conversations outside and leave quietly so that the committee can continue. The next bill in the calendar is House File 1659. Representative Schultz moves that House File 1659 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS omnibus bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1659 is a request for appropriation of money for shelter, services, and other activities for sexually exploited youth and youth at risk of sexual exploitation. And I have a few testifiers. We're going to try to keep it really short, but all of you are familiar with the Safe Harbor, I think, and we're going to find out how that program's been working and what their needs are. Thank you for coming today as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and especially our Chief Author Schultz for bringing this bill forward to be heard today. My name is Beth Holger. I work for a nonprofit that's a youth and adult-led nonprofit called The Link. We provide emergency shelter, housing, and services actually through the Homeless Youth Act, as well as specialized emergency shelter, housing, and supports for victims of trafficking and juvenile justice alternative programs. I want to first thank all of you and this entire legislative body for supporting Safe Harbor and No Wrong Door in previous years, and I won't get into all of the details about that for the sake of time, and also because I think many of you are familiar with Safe Harbor No Wrong Door. We really appreciate that. I also know that many of you have authored this bill, and thank you all so much for that. We greatly appreciate that. Although we've had incredible progress being made in setting up our infrastructure so that now we're treating sex trafficking victims who are honestly being sexually assaulted multiple times every day throughout the night, experiencing extreme violence, so that someone can profit off of those sexual assaults and violence held against them, we still need to do way more for them. We've made a lot of progress, but we need to do more. We're still turning young people as young as 13, 14 away from emergency shelter, still having to sometimes tell FBI agents, I'm sorry, we don't have room in our shelter, and that's just not okay for anyone in our state. Whether you're 12 or whether you're 50, for that matter, we're very supportive of Safe Harbor for All as well. At any rate, we need to do more, and what we're proposing is this funding is going to help provide additional emergency shelter beds that can help young people escape sex trafficking, heal from it, and do the things they want to do with their lives, which honestly, I have two amazing leaders here today in the anti-trafficking movement, Simi and Fawn, and so I would like to now give them an opportunity to speak to this because they are really incredible and have some good things to say. So we really appreciate this. There is more information and handouts with the Safe Harbor White Paper, as well as the results from the small event we had last year called the Super Bowl. We did increase anti-trafficking efforts during that event, as well as we will be again during the Final Four coming up in April. So the Safe Harbor also really helps us with a lot of different things, including large-scale events. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Simi and Fawn.
Thank you, Ms. Holder. Would the next testifier please introduce yourself?
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Fawn Lemieux, and I am a survivor on the Survivor Advisory Committee for Safe Harbor. the way the LINC programs have helped me, when I came in to the LINC, I was very quiet and reserved and stuff because I felt like I didn't really have a voice or my voice wasn't important. But working with the LINC and being a part of this committee has given me a voice and given me the power to sit here in front of you guys and actually speak. the reason why this is so important is because just gonna help youth that you know that need it, and I don't know, just if we don't do it, then who else is gonna do it? This kind of work is really important. So sorry.
Thank you, Ms. Lemieux, so much for being here today and for your testimony. The next testifier, I'd like to introduce herself.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Simeona Williams. I am also on the Survivor Advisory Committee. I used to live at the Link Passageways. It's a place that we actually helped create for people who were like me. I was sexually exploited at a young age. I was there for probably a few years, and the best part about Passageways and being on that the housing side is simply because when you're out there on the streets, they understand that all the bad things that you do and have it when you are on the streets, they don't kick you out and say you can't come back here, you can't be here anymore. They understand. They work with you. They make sure you get good. They make sure you're so you get better at doing at being who you are for the most part. I'm on my own now. I'm in my own place. I'm not going to say I was ever a bad mom, but I'm a better mother. My mind is a bit more clear. I can think better, being that I'm able to come home, being that my daughter knows that we have a home, a safe place to be, and my son knows he has a home and a safe place to be. I just feel like mainly the reason why this should be supported is because it could be anybody. I mean, tomorrow anything could happen to anybody. It could be your kids. It could be anybody out there. Somebody just takes your kid abruptly, take them, put them through the lifestyle, and here they are mentally messed up. And there's a place, there's places like these, like Passageways, and places like the Link that are going to help them. So at least, you know, I just think that's one of the main reasons why this place should still be supported, because there's people out there, and there's, it could happen at any age. It could be anybody, like I said. Just be aware and just keep helping, because you guys are doing a good job.
Thank you so much, Ms. Williams, for being here and for your testimony. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify? Seeing none, any discussion? Seeing none, the Representative Schultz.
I just want to thank the testifiers, Madam Chair, and the members. I hope you will all support this bill as it moves forward. Thank you.
With that, Representative Schultz moves that her bill get laid over for the possible inclusion in the HHS Finance Division bill. Thank you.
Yay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next bill is House File 2033, Representative Lippert. We'll go ahead and move that House File 2033 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Division Bill. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So in my other life, I'm a pastor, and one of the things I do is walk with members of my congregation who are wrestling with substance abuse. And I've learned a few things. One is that good treatment is essential for the pathway to recovery. And I've also learned that the time after treatment is incredibly important for recovery too. That the road to recovery is long and winding, and it's not one that one should walk alone. The more support that can be there, the better off someone will be as they're putting their life back together. And so I'm glad to be here presenting this bill, providing funding for recovery community organizations. They're independent nonprofit organizations that honor all pathways to recovery. They're not treatment providers, but exist to fill gaps in and around treatment, which is typically a short-term intervention. They offer the primary care essential to managing and preventing the chronic disease of substance abuse disorder. So this bill will direct $975,000 in each of the next two fiscal years for grants to recovery community organizations. And here with me to say more about the work that recovery community organizations do is Wendy Jones, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Recovery Connection.
Thank you, Representative Lippert. Please introduce yourself to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, and thank you, Representative Lippert, for authoring this legislation. My name is Wendy Jones, and I am a person in long-term recovery from a substance use disorder. Recovery has made it possible for me to be here today as the Executive Director of Minnesota Recovery Connection and on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Recovery Community Organizations. So the legislation before you today replaces an existing appropriation, modifies some language, and is a slight increase to the appropriation. More importantly, though, it ensures that Minnesota's current network of recovery community organizations can continue to deliver essential peer recovery support services, and that the door is open for more communities to establish local recovery community organizations. So Minnesota has a recovery community organizations in Rochester, Mankato, and the Twin Cities. And recovery community organizations are emerging in St. Cloud, Duluth, Moorhead, and elsewhere. As Representative Lippert pointed out, recovery community organizations are independent, we're nonprofit organizations, and we're led and governed by representatives of local communities of recovery, including people in personal recovery, or family recovery from substance use disorder, and the professionals who serve us. Our board of directors, our staff, and our volunteers are all people from our local recovery communities. And as Representative Lippert pointed out, we're not treatment providers. We fill gaps in and around the treatment system. And we are a critical and highly cost-effective part of the behavioral health continuum. People need to maintain recovery and improve their lives before, during, and long after treatment. The funding from this legislation will support the broad range of peer-based recovery support services provided by recovery community organizations that are not otherwise eligible for Medicaid reimbursement. Examples of these services include training people to become recovery coaches and peer recovery specialists, using a strengths-based approach that honors all pathways to recovery. It includes providing one-to-one peer coaching for people outside of the treatment system, partnering with correctional facilities, treatment courts, emergency departments, first responders, and others to reach populations outside of the treatment system. It includes telephone recovery support, peer support groups such as All Recovery Meetings. It also includes on-call recovery navigation, supporting individuals and families in finding housing, employment, education, and healthy social activities. It includes public education to reduce the stigma associated with substance use disorder, and it includes continuing education and support for Minnesota's emerging workforce of peer recovery specialists. So these and other peer-based recovery support services are an evidence-based health model of care. They are proven to increase recovery outcomes and decrease costs, significantly reducing instances of relapse, hospitalization, incarceration, overdose, and death. I have a stack of research which I could share with you, but I know that we're on time limitations here. Minnesota has over 400 licensed treatment providers, but only 6 recovery community organizations, 4 of which emerged in the last year in response to the demand for our peer recovery support services. Most of these services are provided at no cost to consumers. In addition to losing the substantial investment already made in these recovery community organizations, Minnesota cannot grow and sustain a network of recovery community organizations to match its network of treatment providers without continued investment in recovery. Nationally, there are no successful networks of recovery community organizations that operate without ongoing state support. So at a time when Minnesota needs accessible recovery support services more than ever, we thank you for supporting this legislation to sustain and grow our recovery community organizations. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there questions for members? Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the bill author or the testifier. You mentioned that the $975,000 was an increase from previous allocations that were made. Can you tell us what that amount was and the increase, is the intent with the increase to go to just cover kind of inflation since the last time there was an appropriation, or is it going to expand the program?
Ms. Jones.
Thank you. The increase is it's an increase of $250,000 per year for a total of $500,000 for the biennium, and the increase is intended to enable recovery community organizations to expand. There's a demand for more recovery community organizations, particularly in greater Minnesota, and we are hoping with the support of the existing recovery organizations that we can help build additional recovery community organizations.
Representative Schumacher, okay. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Lippert about I think it's great that we build aftercare supports in a variety of different ways. I had a chance yesterday to meet with a constituent of mine who is a peer support specialist. And we talked about how we have now competing models, and yet peer support services, some have experienced a really common situation of both mental health and CD crisis. Some have only had substance abuse as a challenge. Some have only had mental health. But her concern was that we are getting into really specialized language, and so that people who may have had that dual diagnosis experience and really be gifted in helping with that, she works professionally in crisis, are being closed out when we use recovery support specialist, and if we might be able to work to a uniform term, and that different agencies would hire people with different backgrounds depending upon what their clientele is and their needs. And so I just ask Ms. Jones if you and Representative Lippert, if you'd think about that, I'd be glad to bring her together with you to further explore this. They've just created a professional organization that one hasn't existed for these roles and professions, so that they can support each other in training and peer-to-peer support. And so I'm hoping that as this moves along, we can consider that, because we have so many people who are dual diagnosis and who really do need someone who understands what the complications are of recovery from that, not just from one or the other.
Ms. Jones?
Yes, thank you for Representative Loeffler for bringing that up. We are well aware of that, and we work closely with the Department of Human Services to support them. There is currently movement within DHS to clarify language around peer recovery support. There are currently peer specialists who address mental health and peer recovery specialists who address substance use disorder, and we are promoting a co-occurring training to enable peers to address both disorders simultaneously. One of the advantages of peer recovery support is that an individual has that lived experience with either substance use disorder or a mental health disorder or both. And it's that lived experience that makes them so effective in helping individuals navigate their recovery. So I can tell you at this point that it is an ongoing topic, and we are working closely with the Department of Human Services to ensure that peer support of all shapes and sizes is available and effective.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will continue to pursue that with you, and not just with the Department of Human Services, but also others who are involved in this, because I think it's a really important support that has proven effective, and no matter what the issue is. And I think the more that we divide things up, the more it becomes mm-hmm. difficult to actually meet real needs of people in the community, as opposed to blending opportunities. And if you're only working with people whose only issue is substance abuse, of course you're going to focus on those peers. And if you're focusing on a blended clientele, it might be nice to have a blend of experiences in your peer team. And so we don't need to continue this discussion here. We'll have it offline. But thank you for your work, and I support this effort.
May I respond, Madam Chair?
Jones, yeah.
Just very quickly, I should clarify that recovery community organizations accept all people who come to them, so we never turn anyone away because of one particular disorder or another. Our goal is to work with the individual to find what meets their unique needs and then connect them with resources that may be more specific.
And Ms. Jones, I have a question as well. I don't see any from any other members. You know, we have this thing called Results First now, and I wonder, and excuse me if you already addressed this, because I had to step out at the beginning of your presentation, but have you looked to see whether Results First has any information about the model that you are using? And it's fine if they don't, but I just kind of, you know, asking whether people use that resource and maybe you've contributed to that resource.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am not familiar specifically with Results First and the direct connection with peer recovery support and recovery community organizations. I do know that there have been substantial studies from SAMHSA and CMS and other states where the state single state agency works in close partnership with their RCOs that demonstrate substantial improved outcomes and cost savings for peer intervention.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. And I just... And I know Representative Lippert, you probably wouldn't have thought to do this, but, you know, if that results first, maybe we could talk offline. It would be great to have, to at least know what they've got, whether they have the information you're talking about. Maybe they haven't evaluated this, but I kind of think they might have something that pertains to it. So thank you for that. Any other questions for members? All right. Okay. Seeing none, Representative Mann renews her motion that House File 2033 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS finance bill. So the bill is laid over. Thank you very much. House File 1961, Representative Lippert, and so the chair will move House File 1961 that it be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS finance bill. And again, Representative Lippert, if you want to give us an opening statement for your bill, and then we'll hear from you testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm glad to be carrying this bill that provides funding for community action grants. In the two communities that I've lived in and served churches in, I've learned firsthand how community action programs are key partners in the community. So fresh out of seminary, I served a congregation in Dodgeville, Wisconsin, and was on a team that started a free health clinic there. And the community action program was the glue that held that initiative together, both in providing some staffing support, helping us find a facility, helping us also figure out how we could expand our services as we serve the community. And as I've lived in Northfield, Three Rivers Community Action Program is a key partner for affordable housing, transportation, childcare, and as we look to continue to address those needs, we'll be turning in our community to Three Rivers Community Action to help us start new programs that are needed. So this bill allocates $4 million in 2020 and $4 million in 2021 for community action grants. This is a core funding for Minnesota's statewide community action network. The current base funding is about half of that, and House File 1961 is seeking to restore the cut made in 2004 and restore this funding to previous levels. And with that, I'll turn it over to Arnie Anderson, who can say more about community action.
All right. Welcome to the committee, and please just state your name for the record and go ahead and give your testimony.
Thank you very much, Representative Lippert. Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here today. I think you all have received our new annual report, literally hot off the presses this morning. I'm sorry, Arnie Anderson, Minnesota Community Action Partnership. Do we have an advanced draft copy for you? As indicated by the 162 pages, we could spend 8 hours talking with you and would love that opportunity. But
I'm sorry, we don't have that today.
But we understand, and we have some brief prepared comments for today. Community action agencies are on a need-to-know basis for elected officials. When you need help with your constituent services, then you know your local CAF agency. For low-income families, especially families that have lost their job or other financial disasters, then they know their local community action agency. Stated a different way, using an old-school analogy, community action agencies aren't show ponies. We're workhorses. We just quietly get the work done. In the next 2 minutes, I'm going to provide a very high-level overview of Minnesota's statewide community action network. Our CAP network is Minnesota's largest statewide nonprofit network, serving 500,000 low-income Minnesotans each year. In your report, you have three handouts that were inserted on page 24, and please keep track of page 24. The blue map is our statewide map, 24 private nonprofits serving all 87 counties and all 11 tribal nations. The multicolored grid depicts all of the different types of programming from birth to end of life, delivered by CAPS all around the state. The color-coded key at the bottom on both sides is all the major state agencies that rely on CAHPS to deliver programming. There are a couple of points that I would like to make with this matrix. First, it's important to know that by federal statute, CAHPS are prohibited from duplicating services otherwise provided in the community. Periodically, we conduct local needs assessments and develop programming to fill local unmet needs, and that explains much of the variability between local CAHPS as they have evolved over the years. Second, much of what CAHPS do can be understood as employment supports. We try to creatively solve problems and prevent disasters, and in that vein, we very strongly support Representative Cantrell's House File 1043. As you've heard, the housing support programs are absolutely a vital tool in the big picture of restoring families to stability and economic self-reliance. Moving on, what's our secret sauce? Governance of community action agencies is unique by federal statute. Each board of directors must have at least one-third low income, one-third local community leaders, and one-third local elected officials. Your CAHPS Board of Directors is a remarkable and extremely durable local institution. They have been quietly and creatively going about their business for more than 50 years. Now, back to page 24 of the report. This is the section on outcome-based programming. CAP programs are not within the scope of MMB's results-first activities. However, as a national network, our work on outcome-based management systems began 25 years ago. In my case, personally, I was appointed by the governor to serve on the DHS Human Services Performance Council as a nonprofit sector member, in part because of our extensive experience. In closing, please look at the yellow-colored graphic depicting the funding. House File 1961 proposes to restore the 2004 cut to Community Action's core source of funding, the Community Action Grant. And then now think about that multicolored matrix again. Most of those resources use a top-down categorical model. By contrast, when you fund the Community Action Grant, you are deploying a complementary model of local control and local flexibility that allows CAHPS to make the best possible use of all of those resources combined. Based on the needs of individual, real-life families, one family at a time. Thank you very much for your consideration. And with that, I'm pleased to introduce Jenny Larson, Executive Director of Three Rivers Community Action, headquartered in Zumbrota, serving Goodhue, Olmsted, Rice, and Wabasha counties.
And thank you, Mr. Anderson. And before we go on to the next testifier, just you'd handed out to the committee some materials. We have to post everything for the public as well, and in this case, we didn't have that in advance to post. I wonder if you have the pages that you've referred to, do you have them electronically that you can provide that to the committee and then we can post them for the public?
Yes, Madam Chair, we're happy
to. So we'll do that way. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Lippert. Thank you for having me. My name is Jenny Larson. I'm the Executive Director at Three Rivers Community Action. We're an organization of 175 employees working across our four-county area. Serving about 14,000 people every year. I'm happy to be here today, particularly on Homeless Day on the Hill. Housing is a core activity of our statewide community action network, as are self-sufficiency, early childhood programming, transportation, and senior services. While our agencies may have commonality in these core activities, each community action agency is unique in that we develop local strategies to address the needs of families and individuals with low incomes in our areas. The Community Action Grant is an essential resource that allows us to develop and launch those local solutions. I could give you a lot of different examples of things that we've done with the Community Action Grant over the years, but I picked out just one to talk about today. Three Rivers has been working to address the opportunity gaps faced by communities of color in our region. We know that in Minnesota, households of color earn, save, and own at rates that are much lower than their white neighbors. Working closely with culturally based nonprofits, faith leaders, and the business community, Three Rivers has developed a comprehensive set of services that aim to build assets in communities of color in southeast Minnesota. Our diverse staff offer financial literacy classes, one-on-one financial empowerment coaching, match savings programs, homebuyer education and counseling, and down payment assistance. We track results for each participant, and we're seeing increases in income, increases in savings, and increases in credit score. Most importantly, we now have over 450 households of color who have successfully purchased their first home in southeast Minnesota. In 2019, we're using the Community Action Grant to add a post-purchase homebuyer class to our array of services. Those classes will teach our new homeowners how to operate and maintain their homes, with an emphasis on energy savings and preventative maintenance that will ensure long-term affordability and success in their ownership.
Okay, and I'm sorry to rush you, but we really have to wrap it up if you could finish.
Yep. I'll end with a story. Last week I was talking with one of our new homeowners in Rochester, and she said every day her kids wake up in their new home and they ask her, "Is this really our house?" She says, "Yes, we're going to stay here forever," and they dance around the room with joy. So that's what Community Action and the Community Action Grant can bring to the state of Minnesota.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And we have one more test for her. I have to ask you to keep it really brief because we have one more bill.
I will. I'm really good at that. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Lori Schultz. I am the executive director for TRICAP. We are the local community action agency for the counties of Stearns, Benton, and Sherburn. And I'll just briefly share how one of the unique ways we use community action funds, and that is to support our tax assistance program. We have one of the largest tax assistance programs in the state. We served 1,900 households last year and brought back $3 million in tax refunds to the local community from the services that we provided, mostly done by volunteers. We're not able to do that program without community action funds. On a statewide level, there was 13,800 households served throughout the state last year. Not only is it tax assistance, but we couple it with financial literacy skills as well. And the last thing I would say is I want to give an example in Sherburn County. 4 years ago, TRICAP did not have a tax site in that area. We knew there were people that needed that service. So with the help of Representative Nick Zerwas, who's not here right now, we started a tax clinic there. And what we found was that there were people that were coming in that hadn't filed their taxes in 4 and 5 years. That is, in my opinion, an example to show that there is a need, and that is how community action agencies can assist with this type of funding. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there questions for members?
I'll be really quick because I need not be able to be heard. But I just wanted to just share that Community Action is an organization that really works to lift people out of poverty. And the work that they do, you know, I mean, this document says a lot about what they do and how they do around and do it around the state of Minnesota. It's just really just supports really families, children, and whole communities. And so I just want to say thank you, Representative Lippert, for bringing this bill forward and recognizing the work of Community Action Partnership.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Moran. I won't have to give my speech now. Okay. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just briefly, thank you, Representative, for bringing the bill. And just wanted to call out that thank you, Jenny, for coming to testify. I worked with Jenny before in a previous life. And when I visit with my county every about 6 months, Jenny's always there. And so I know the coordination in our counties is really well done by Community Action. And thank you for your work.
All right. Thank you. Is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify on this bill? All right, seeing none, thank you very much, testifiers and Representative Lippert. So House File 1961 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Finance Bill. House File 1602, Representative Moran. All right. Representative Moran moves that House File 1602 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS finance bill. Representative Moran, go ahead and start presenting.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also have an A2 amendment.
Yes. Okay. Representative Moran moves, members have it in their packets, and Representative Moran moves the A2 to get the bill in the order in which she would like to discuss it. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Moran.
Madam Chair and members, I've been doing a lot of work this session around child protection, out-of-home placement, and reunification of parents and families. And one of the things that we know often is that when children are removed from their homes, those parents have to navigate the system alone by themselves, which can be very cumbersome. And so the work of Minnesota One-Stop Parent Mentoring Program does just that through a parent mentoring process where they rigorously involve families in their formal and informal support in order to prevent children from entering to the foster care system. And then if they do enter, to be returned and not removed again. And so I'm going to be really, really short because we have some really great testifiers here who can really talk about the work of the program and the results of the programs using evidence-based practices.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Who's going to go first?
Hi.
Just say your name for the record and then go ahead.
My name is Lorraine Randall Wade. So thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I am the executive director for an organization called Minnesota One Stop for Communities. We are a new organization. We are the home of the Parent Mentor Program. The Parent Mentor Program has been in existence since 2012. So in your packets, you'll see I've put two documents. One is a one-pager from our board chair, and the other is preliminary findings from Wendy Haight, who is our evaluator from the University of Minnesota, which our evaluation is due to be published in the summer at a National Child Welfare Conference. So with that being said, we were given legs to walk in 2012 at the William Mitchell, at that time, Law College in their child protection clinic. And it was just two parent mentors at that time. In 2015, Casey Family Programs gave expansion dollars to start in Ramsey County Court and in St. Louis County Indian Child Welfare Courts. The Parent Mentor Program hired its first three parent mentors in August of 2015. In September 2016, as of September 2016, we now have eight parent mentors. We also filed for our 501c3 in 2016, which we are now officially a 501c3. At the end of 2016, we had impacted the lives of 85 individuals. That's parents, mother, father, and child or children. At the end of 2017, we had impacted 268 individuals. And at the end of 2018, there was 302 individuals whose lives we had impacted by having 97 reunifications since we've started, 43 transfer of legal custody to kin, and 30 termination of parental rights, and those parents still deserve to have supports while walking through that process, as well as we only have had one reentry since the start of this work, and that reentry turned around really quick, and those children were able to go back home with their mother. Parent mentors, as Representative Moran said, actively work to involve families and with formal and informal supports in order to prevent out-of-home placement. This is what that's what's called active efforts in the ICWA Act. And we have a Native American parent mentor in St. Louis County who's doing wonderful work up there in Carlton County as well as St. Louis County. This is the standard that all children deserve this care. This is the care that parent mentors provide to the families that we engage with. This is the standard of care that we hope to continue to provide for families, where they create networks of support, where they work to involve the tribes, where they provide trauma-informed services, where they build protective factors that support parents and their children in a healthy lifestyle. In the 2018 DHS Child Protection Report, it said that there were 8,668 Minnesota children in care. And to us, as parent mentors, as an organization, we believe that we can do better. So we're hoping that we can continue to be a solution to this problem to help parents navigate this system. It's kind of like a hand-holding thing. But as we can look at our numbers, we've had 97 reunifications. 97 children have went home. And at this time, that's why I'm asking that this funding be able to go forward so that we can open up statewide. We've been in 7 counties since we started, but there are counties that don't have access to this service, and we would like to provide more access to families all over. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. So we have about 5 minutes left in this hearing, and I would like to give each of you a chance to speak. So, you know, if we could ask you to please make it really short. So next testifier, please.
Hello, my name is Joanna Woolman. I'm here from Mitchell Hamlin School of Law, where I direct our Institute for Children, Families, and Communities. The Parent Mentor Program started with our institute, and I am just here to say what a huge difference it can make in the lives of a family and in the lives of a child. The process of a child protection case and navigating the system is scary and confusing for parents. This is a resource that tremendously helps that process. It helps parents get to a safe home more quickly, and it helps children in the long run. This bill helps Minnesota take a huge step. I'm sorry, this proposal takes a huge step forward in our disparity issues, and by giving real focus and financial support to an agency that is doing disparity work. For the amount of money that is being asked for, the impact of this could be phenomenally huge. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Afternoon, sorry. My name is Robert O'Connor. I'm a faculty member at Metropolitan State University Social Work Program and director of our Child Welfare Title IV-E program. I'm also a board member and a former state ward who was separated from his family, not reunified, across state lines, multiple failed adoptions and foster care placements, and it took me 30-some years to be able to reunify with my family. And so my experience and my commitment to working here on this board and on behalf of our families, I also worked at our Minnesota Department of Human Services in adoptionship and guardianship, so I have perspectives from being a state ward all the way through being state ward administrator and working with the federal government child welfare system, and knowing what innovative programming looks like. And this is something that is very innovative, something I fought for when I was on the governor's task force for child welfare reform. And I did champion the disparities dollars, and this is essentially why we did that work. And just speak in favor of it, and I'll end with that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for members? Is there anyone else in the room who wanted to testify on this bill? All right. Not seeing anybody. So, okay.
Madam Chair,
yeah,
that's really one thing that we didn't share. When we talk about parent mentors, these are all parents who have gone through the system themselves, right, have been reunified with their kids and know exactly how to navigate that system and be that support for parents who are going through that system. It's very unique. It's very powerful. And it also shows the impact of having support and how we can create change not just within one family but a whole community.
All right. Thank you, Representative Moran. And I just have a brief question since we have 2 minutes here. A couple questions. One is, do we appoint attorneys when there's a potential removal of a child from a family? Do the parents get an attorney in our current system?
If they fall in the guideline.
Randall Waite, right?
I'm sorry. Sorry, Madam Chair. If they fall under the guidelines income-wise, then they are provided a parent attorney or a public defender, depending on what county it is. If they are above the income threshold, then they have to find their own attorney.
Okay. So,
and I think we need, Madam Chair, to talk a little bit about what that representation looks like. Usually on the first court date, they are there.
So Ms. Woolman.
Thank you. Our statute in Minnesota is actually only one of five in the country that's discretionary, meaning the judges have the option to appoint an attorney but are not mandated to. So we're out of line with the rest of the country with respect to that. In about half the counties in Minnesota, parents do not have attorneys representing them at their initial court hearing for removal. And my experience, we've done quite a bit of research on this, is that most custodial parents are ultimately getting an attorney appointed if they're indigent. Non-custodial parents, it may take a little bit longer, and they may not have an attorney appointed until much later in the process. And the way that plays out is that often fathers don't have attorneys very early in the case.
Okay, so I'm taking it that your proposal here kind of fills a gap, or is it intended to be used also where there's an attorney?
This goes hand in hand with an attorney. So parent mentors work alongside clients and often are working with attorneys, but the roles are very different. You need an attorney to navigate the court process. You need a parent mentor to navigate the child welfare process.
Okay, thank you for that. And then finally, not that you have to give this to me here, but I haven't had a chance to read the handouts that you had, but I'm interested to know if there's sort of, you mentioned a lot of really great impacts, you know, families that are kept together, families that are unified, and I just wonder if you have data that you can give us and if there's been any study about, you know, people that had that intervention versus families that didn't. I mean, that would be more helpful than just raw data about, you know, how many, you know what I'm asking for here, so that there's some that we can actually maybe show that the impact with and without the parent mentor. Please, Ms. Randall Wade.
Yes, Madam Chair. There's a lot of national data. This program mimics a program from Iowa, who has been running a program now probably for about 10 years with what they call parent partner supports. And it's fully funded by their state. And they work hand in hand with the child welfare system. There are states like Colorado. There are states like Washington. For us, as I had mentioned before, our evaluation is now it's pretty much complete. And the handout that you have in there is just some preliminary findings, but the finalization of that will be published for the public come this summer in June, and it will have a lot of more data tied to that. I hope that helps.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. We have to make our decisions before June, I hope. Never know. But anyway, if you have anything in addition, if you could provide it to the committee, I think that would be very helpful. We are over time.
I can get some reports to the committee. There's quite a few national reports
here. All right. Thank you very much. And members, we need to approve the minutes of March 12th. Is there a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Loeffler moves to approve the minutes of March 12th, 2019. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, minutes are approved. And I'm sorry I did that out of order because your bill is laid over. So House File 1602 is laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. And thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And members, we are adjourned.